Hello everyone, welcome to today's episode of your Data HQ. We have Michael Zhang here with us today. Michael Zhang is a research scientist working on AR and VR systems in Reality Lab at Facebook or Meta. He obtained his PhD in computer science from UC Santa Barbara in 2021. His research track was focusing on edge cloud computing, IoT devices, and intelligent offloading in distributed systems. He is concerned with data science, machine learning, and AR or VR, all technologies that could potentially influence humanity. So thank you so much, Michael, for being here with us today.
Hi there, Sanjana. Hey, you amazing audience of you, your data headquarter. Great to meet you all. I'm Michael Zhang. I graduated last year with my PhD in computer science from UC Santa Barbara, and that's where I met Sanjana, and I was so amazed by her talent, and we become very good friends since then. When I was in the grad school, my research track was focusing on cloud computing, particularly edge cloud and IoT devices, distributed system, and intelligent offloading, as Sanjana said. Currently, I'm a research scientist working in Reality Lab at Facebook Meta, building the runtime of the next-gen AR glasses, codenamed Project Nazara. Thank you, Sanjana, for having me on her podcast to share some of my thoughts about data science, AI, AR, VR, and technology in general.
Awesome. Thank you so much for that introduction. And the business area that you're working in is, I think, very new, like a very new market as such. And I'm assuming you have to, you know, define the AI problems, the path of the project in accordance with the business objectives. So how do you go about doing that?
Sure. So to answer this question, I think we should back up a little bit to late 2011, when the most important milestone in my mind for iPhone in its history, iPhone 4, has just released and also gained tremendous traction in the world since it introduced the Retina display and also the front-facing, you know, camera that makes FaceTime possible. But you know, unlike Apple, Facebook was having its first, I think, mid-age crisis after its IPO, like that, when it saw a very sluggish increase in its user base on desktop application for the first time. Then we have, you know, Zuckerberg initiated a company-wide pivot to target mobile that eventually transferred a social and advertising experience. The pivot was very successful. So that's why Facebook and Instagram continue to dominate the social media on mobile up to now. But Facebook was still lacking a very valid internet and traffic entry, and also had laid its eyes on the next gen computational platform by acquiring Oculus in 2014, if I remember that correctly. So now let us fast forward to 2020, when Apple adopts the so-called App Tracking Transparency, ATT, in the iOS 14. Since then, Facebook has never been so determined to have its internet entry devices, throughout its 18 years of life, because it basically just at the mercy of Apple. It costs a lot of revenue for like Facebook or Snapchat or any social media at this point.
Right.
But here comes the question, okay? So mobile phone actually has already made human beings addicted to the internet badly enough. So how could Facebook provide a better experience than that? Hmm. If we look at what Facebook had at this point, right? See what Facebook has. Two largest social media, Instagram and Facebook. Two largest messaging apps, Messenger and WhatsApp. And a trendy virtual reality headset, Oculus. So what can Zuckerberg come about? The metaverse, right? It obviously has, a lot of, multiple floors. It means, different things to different people. But for me, I think it means a ever immersive internet experience in the metaverse. And also its capability to seamlessly blend in our daily life, namely the augmented reality, instead of virtual reality. So my belief and also my team's belief is in 1 to 2 decades, we will be the replacement for the smartphone in most of the user cases, and also change how human beings live their lives in many aspects. You can imagine this, everything you want to do on your phone, you can do it better on your AR glasses because you have this very immersive you know, surrounding, and you can do whatever you want on all those virtual objects instead of, you know, just swiping and clicking on your phone. You know, personally, I'm very, you know, hopeful and also looking forward to the next iPhone moment to happen, either in Facebook or maybe other competitors in this time frame. Okay, so with that background, we should hold this business object in the mind, right? So we want these AR glasses. So here comes a series of really hard questions to define and solve. So I will take two examples. First, how could user interact with augmented reality? Okay, I will bring up a little bit background again. So let's talk about computer history. The I/O devices of computer have evolved dramatically since the computer was created. For anyone, I recently visited the Museum of Computer History in Mountain View, California. For any computer, if you ever got a chance to visit there as well, please try to punch holes on a programming punch card. That is very fun. I think that would be on your imagination to code in a punch card on an IBM 1130 mainstream machine. And also, you know, they have an exhibit. You can see a red line on the side of a pile of punch cards that will mark its order because, you know, sometimes you fumble and you have to like reorganize them again. So this is a very, very OG IO devices to interact with computers. And then we invented monitors, keyboards, mice, and touch screens. However, they don't really fit into this augmented reality world because users are not outside the computer. They actually are a part of augmented reality themselves, right? They're in this very immersive surrounding you know, environment. The human-computer interaction should be based on the fine motor of users' eyes, fingers, gestures. So tracking them become a crucial part of building this immersive internet experience. So Facebook actually acquired Control Lab in 2019, and it keeps working on a wristband that tracks the neuromuscular signal of your hands and transfer and interpret them based on a classification model, and also enable users to interact seamlessly with virtual objects in the augmented reality world. Though, you know, this is still in a very early stage of research and also, you know, far from a practical application. But, you know, this is a very promising path, I can see. And also, Google actually has its fine-grained gesture recognition solution as well by using the reflection of electromagnetic waves in a broad beam. You know, in a layman's term, it basically used a miniature radar to recognize, you know, all your gestures. I don't really have the statistics about, you know, the accuracy across all these technology, but in my opinion, AR devices themselves should be smart enough to interpret human intention and also without any peripherals that should be able to provide all these either, you know, visual or haptic feedbacks in the real time. So that's my belief of if you have a business object, how you should define it and how you should solve a consequential problems to really achieve your goal in a business.
Got it. So I think to summarize, so it has to do with just the market scenario in general, like what the competitors are doing, where do we want to be placed? And secondly, like just in terms of how are the supporting companies overall, like the internet and, you know, going from interacting with the system through keyboard and mouse or trackpad to actually interacting with it through our, you know, regular motions, hand motions or eye motions, and think about it from, you know, the product usability perspective. So
that's correct.
While you were mentioning these, I think it's not just, you know, and you did a very good job at painting a good picture on, you know, all of the innovation so far that has led to this moment. So it's not just about, you know, a single system. It's like so many moving components are there. And from the perspective of AI projects, like how do we ensure sustained innovation involving, you know, so many components, either as an individual or as a team, how do we develop this ability?
Sure. That's a very good segue. So in my opinion, I think it doesn't really matter in what firm it comes. Every business should be a people business, because any sustainable business has to address some aspect of human beings' demand, right? So this also applies to AI project as well, as we cannot really develop AI just for AI's sake. But we have to consider how the technology can advance our ability positively. For example, I can never forget the first time I realized I can simply just type whatever question I have into Google, and it will basically return a collection of web pages in which I can find a meaningful answer. To me, that was artificial intelligence like 20 years ago. But, you know, and also I have this exactly the blow away moments recently with ChatGPT, right? We have a lot of buzzwords floating around. When I found it returns fundamentally better results for technical questions than Google. Like, you know, I was asking what's the difference between, you know, different system calls like POL and EPOS in the Linux kernel, and returns, you know, really insightful answers. It basically reinforced our ability to search quickly and accurately on the internet. And this is obviously a core demand for everyone using internet. On the flipping side, we also need to think hard about how AI projects could possibly affect our lives negatively and put a guardrail if we want to be sustainable. Taking a deeper look into the GPT model, which, you know, ChatGPT uses, a majority of the mechanism is just to summarize coherent sentences and rephrase it in a linguistically better fashion.
Yeah.
So that's why I heard a lot of people just call ChatGPT a convincing bullshitter. So it's, you know, sometimes it just, you know, churn out a lot of like really structurally beautiful sentences, but is meaningless, right?
Yeah.
So that said, a natural question that follows up is how can we differentiate corporate generated from the ChatGPT model and prevent all these manipulative content? For the from the user perspective, since it's led us to skip the aggregation of information that we search from different sources, so who will be the watchdogs and fact checkers to verify the authenticity of all these results? And how could we make sure the training data is legitimate before training the GPT model? And also, if ChatGPT become persuasive in our society, is OpenAI or Microsoft too powerful in their positions? And also whether we should introduce more new regulations to make it you know, more legit. So all these are really important questions to ask in the research and the legal community. From my perspective, technology would move forward regardless of the, you know, some of these side effects, but we have to set the guardrail along the way. So you may ask me, where is the guardrail, right? So back to my point, I think it is the positive humanity demands, meaning it has to benefit the humanity somehow. It might have some side effects, but in the long term, you know, we have to go back to this principle. You know, whether it will benefit you know, the humanity in the long term. This tug of war between the liberalism and the conservatism in you know, technology development should always be there. But like as I said, they will always come back to this principle by the end of the day.
Yeah, I think even the conservatism versus liberalism is just different user perspectives, right? Like, and it's just like, you know, while you develop a UX, you know, somebody might want an orange button, somebody might want a blue button, and you have to like sort of develop a compromise between them. And so it's all about like, if people are really scared about, hey, is ChatGPT going to replace my job? Then you actually have to, you know, address that question. So I think what you're saying is to, for sustained innovation, start thinking about people and then listen to people and then ask questions that will solve the people's said problems and reiterate. So that would be the path for sustained innovation.
Yeah, that's right. I want to add on a little bit on your points. I think you made a very good point. We should listen to people, and also in tech industry, we tend to do A/B testing to really test all these technical decisions before really implement them. But for something like this, which concerns of humanity, aesthetics, the experiment usually is very, very important and also efficient. So you cannot really say, for example, in biology field, I will just make a baby and, buy the edited, gene in, and then, have this, experiment to see, okay, if it's, that is good or not. So it's too much price to pay. So that's why all this debate actually, going on and on, trying to say, okay, this is good or bad. So it's not that easy. People always have their opinions. So a development benefit everyone normally is not possible. And they'll always face a lot of headwinds or vandalism, hopefully not, for all these technology developments. But, like I said, I think the technology will move forward regardless of all these, setbacks and headwinds. But in the long term, I do think the regulation should be introduced to provide a guardrail. And where that is, it's basically up to, how people, discuss and debate and, based on the historical path, throughout all these developments. That was my point.
Okay, that's very well put. So you have a great background and experience. You've gone in depth into, so many relevant topics in your PhD, and you're working on a breakthrough product right now at Meta. From your experience, what do you think are some things that a textbook or just a conventional course cannot teach that people should know about?
Sure. I think on that point, Hacker News and Alchive are your best friends. Like, no kidding. If you follow up Alchive closely, there will be average about 300 preprints every single week coming out in the artificial intelligence section. So how can we survive? First, I think because it's impossible to catch up with them all researchers need to hone their skills and acumen of discovering breakthrough papers. Believe me, as you read more, you can clearly tell from its title, its summary, and also all the charts to really understand. Reading this paper is worth the next 60 minutes of my life or not. So you don't really have to waste a lot of time on those low quality papers. Second, I think learning from people instead of paper. Yeah. That's my secret sauce. So go talk to your lab mates, colleagues and peers in the conference as often as possible, and also get amazed by how many creative ideas you can really pull off from all these conversations. Because every single person in my mind is a map reducer for all the information he or she receives. Getting all these knowledge and ideas not only save you a lot of time and energy, but also keeps you at a cutting edge of all these research areas. Third, I think learning from doing. That's very important. We have to admit reproducibility has been a major problem in the AI research community as of now. All these, the so-called achieved results, sometimes you really have to verify them locally, right? So this process I found is very, very important and also, 10 times more valuable than reading another 10 low quality papers. Because I believe vision without execution is merely just a hallucination, right? So those are some points, I want to make to help everyone to really learn and adopt continuously in this field.
Got it. So looks like you also do a lot, outside of your regular work at Meta and to stay up to date with all of this. So what are some tools and techniques you use to stay organized?
So the tool and techniques, there are a lot. And also thank you for bringing me up because I'm a very organized person. hopefully not on the level of OCD. I like to give three tips for researchers. First, organize your paper collection, because it will be very frustrating if you have to go over piles of paper just to find an equation you vaguely remember you saw 2 weeks ago. Believe me, that happens a lot to me. So having a categorized online paper collection is a game changer. There are many other options. However, I think I use Zotero, and it has a Chrome extension, which is very convenient. Second, take digital notes and make them searchable by hashtags. Whether you use just vanilla micro MacBook notes or Evernote or whatever, just make sure you have folders and also adds dates and hashtags to your notes to make this searchable later. And the third is make them graphic. Make charts, make diagrams, use photographs, use whatever you can make them more graphical. Normally one chart speaks louder than 10 pages of notes. So tools of drawing charts, I like Excalibur, which is very easy and free and very graceful to use. I think one of the best in the space. Apple just released its freeform app for this type of work, which is also very useful. Yeah, those are some, tips for being organized.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to try them out. And I think the listeners will also try some of them out. Thank you for listing them. So finally, what do you think is the best way to structure a team of data professionals, like, data ops, data engineering, analytics, and then scientists and machine learning engineers?
Okay, cool. This is a very good question. There are some conventions actually in the tech industry on how to build up entire pipeline, right? Data engineers set up the data pipeline from the source and funnel the data to data lake for further inquiries. Well, data scientists and machine learning engineers define telemetry and build up models, and the data analytic person just interpret data without and come up with a dashboard for demonstration or presentation. Bravo, this is good. But I found everyone having a defined role in a structure as a very specific role is a double-edged sword, since it might make each role silo from each other. Sometimes you don't really have this meaningful information flow throughout this pipeline. So in my opinion, we can encourage two kinds of collaboration to improve this structure. First, collaboration across data engineer and software engineer. Soft engineers are people who are at the forefront of the code base, and data engineers are closest to the raw data. So I have observed many times that telemetry becomes very obsolete and inaccurate because the code base has changed since the time data engineer compared to them in the old version of the code base. So in my opinion, all the performance timestamps, like memory footprints, DAU and MAU counters, and also the churn rate, for example, software engineers should be the ones to add them and also keep updating them in the evolving code base, also with the collaboration with data engineers. Yeah. Second, collaboration across the data science production manager and also the user experience researchers. This is how the data science can get a first-hand understanding of the business incentives and also the user requirements, and then defend the better telemetries to reflect the authentic user experience and the business trends. AR, VR, because I worked in this field, is very different from the mobile, since users as a part of the entire system. So we need a new set of metrics to track users themselves, such like eye and hand tracking accuracy, motion sickness, movement jittering, etc. So all these requires a lot of brainstorming by data science product manager and also the user experience researchers.
That's actually very interesting that you brought it up, that the people at the front of the code base should be the ones influencing the data models to some extent, because otherwise you're dealing with very outdated or bulky or not so modular or useful data models. And you know, something like how the client side or server side events that you notice itself has changed through code. For example, in AR, VR, we're actually tracking and logging completely different events. And so how, you know, this cross collaboration would actually help. And likewise, you know, data scientists and machine learning experts always keeping in mind the user stories and user research. So that's actually a very good idea. Thank you for that.
Okay. Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay, so thank you, Michael, for this very insightful podcast and giving us a refresher on all things innovation in this field of computer science. It was very enjoyable. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. I have some last words. So I always encourage everyone to be an active listener.
Mm-hmm.
So active listening actually sounds very easy, but actually it could be your superpower because listening facilitates engagement, connection, and also collaboration. So, you know, normally when people listen, most people are just waiting for their time to talk.
Mm-hmm.
But active listeners actually pay close attention to their counterparts and also ask meaningful questions instead of just, you know, popping up their own stories. So this is very fundamental to learning from other researchers, echoing to my previous point. So I think all the audience for this podcast are, you know, very, you know, inquisitive and also active listeners as well. And also Sandrina did an awesome job, incredible job, accommodating this program. I listened all the previous episode also. So thank you very much for, you know, having me. And I would like to talk more. Yeah, I would like to talk more in the future when our vision of AR become a little bit closer.
Awesome. We'll definitely do another one. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Bye.
See you later.